how did Linux become a thing at CERN if it's a completely bottoms-up?
Okay, it didn't. Linux came late at CERN.
Well,
Unix came.
Well, Unix came for sure, because Linux
and all its dialects came. And almost all the big development was done with different flavors of proprietary Unix.
Right.
So, Unix came in 80... let me see. I came back from my sabbatical in probably 82. We had the first Unix machine in CERN. I should remember because the guy was just talking about it. When I came back from my sabbatical, it was 78. Unix came a couple of years later, 81. And we got a Berkeley flavored one because we had a Unix guru, a German guy, who was actually very good. And he had a good sense of what Unix to get. And I believe I was told by another guy who worked on this that Bill Joy came as well early on and helped CERN with it. So CERN all, but well, that was one machine they had at CERN, and it was used for cross compiling. It was just an obscure thing. It wasn't the mainline thing at all. Yeah. So, but Unix came slowly. The big drive was with the Cray, and at that point, because Unix didn't have features for running batch jobs at that time. I remember very well when IBM was asked, because we were a big IBM shop, do you have Unix? We could have a Unix. Yes, we've got Unix. Do you have tape support? So the salesman went away, came back. Oh, we have tape support. TAR. No. We mean all that, of course. We developed with Cray. Cray came. And Cray understood about batch jobs. Mm-hmm. They had an NQS scheduler, they had a job scheduler, and Cray understood you needed to schedule tapes and so on. So, but Cray did a lot of that development with the CERN colleagues, and it was in doing that development around Cray's units we call Unicos, between 86, 87, and 89, that we understood enough about how you can put these features into Unix to make Unix work on a mainframe. And then the idea was as follows. In the early 80s, we had obtained and seen and obtained an Apollo D-Entente. Have you ever heard of the Apollo?
No.
Yeah. That's very important. The Apollo was the first serious workstation from a little company in Chelmsford, later got bought by Hewlett-Packard. I'll never forget this. The guy came in 1980, and he gave a talk with nice transparencies about this new workstation, and this workstation came on a ring. It had a token ring of their own, 12 megabit token ring called Apollo Domain, and these Apollo machines were so advanced they could page memory over the network. So you had virtual memory.
Wow.
Virtual network memory. 1980, yeah. 81. And these, not only the guy. We said, you know, oh, do you run Fortran? Of course. Yes. Do you run this? Do you do this? Yes. And people thought it was just snow job.
Yeah.
So CERN, it was very impressive, the presentation, but was it real? So CERN sent one of their very best programmers to Chelmsford and to see if this worked. And he took his tape, of course, with the biggest simulation program of that time with him, and went off to run some tests. First thing he found out is he'd brought the wrong tape. He brought the IBM version instead of the VAX version, and the if defs for the VAX would be almost right for the Apollo, but the if defs he had to edit 100,000 lines of code, okay? Now, you couldn't do that at CERN on any machine. Well, maybe with Wilbur, but it was super difficult to do. There was certainly no workstation of any sort, or even the mainframe. So the guy thought he was finished, you know. So the guy said, well, what's the problem? Oh, I've got to edit 100,000. Well, what's the problem? Go ahead. So, you know, and not only, it wasn't a line editor, it was a screen editor.
Yeah.
Most beautiful thing. And in half an hour or so, he'd done this, you know. And then he could compile his 100,000 lines of Fortran, which no one thought it would ever do, and it did it very quickly. And the thing ran. And then CERN got interested. bitmap display, you know, mouse, it's something never been seen, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it was expensive. So CERN bought a few of these. Anyway, a bit by the end of the 80s, these were very well established at CERN, the physicists liked them.
Mm.
It wasn't running Unix, it was running a domain operating system. It was Unix-like.
Mm-hmm.
Later, they were very clever. Later, they put shells in. They put a BSD shell and a System 3, System 5 shell as well, so you could run two Unix flavors or domain. Very cleverly done. So it was a great hit, this machine.
Yeah.
Anyway, they announced their latest model, the N10000 it was called. It had four CPUs and 1 gigabyte disk on it, I remember. And I had this idea. We'd seen these things could run serious computing, and I had the idea that why don't we try and run batch physics on this thing and see how fast it is, see if it would do it. The batch were scripts, basically, big scripts, and they would need data from, you know, and they would need to read tapes and things like this. But the way the mainframes did this, the Cray in particular, they would stage the data. So you get a job in, and in the job control, you would see that it was going to need tapes.
Mm-hmm.
So it would, if it had never seen this tape before, it would order that the tape be mounted. Mm-hmm. The tape would be mounted, and the data would be read from the tape, or the files you needed, maybe all of the tape, onto a disk called staging.
Okay.
Yeah. And then the machine, then the job would go into execution. Yeah. The execution would be done against the disk. The tape could be dismounted. So it wouldn't be slowed down by that. Although this model of running jobs was standard in the computer center, probably many centers.
Mm.
So I said, well, why shouldn't we do this with an Apollo? And all we had to do was connect it to the Cray. Now, the tapes, I should tell you, tapes were all in the IBM. The Cray didn't have tapes.
Mm-hmm.
But the Cray had very expensive software and channel connections under the floor between the Cray and the IBM. So the Cray could order a tape to be mounted before a job ran, and that tape would actually be staged, mounted on the IBM and staged across, across a channel or whatever. So why not do this with an Apollo? I mean, my idea was that to offer the users a service, they wouldn't know if their job was being done on the Cray or the Apollo. IBM would be different because the job control was all different, and you know. But the Cray was Unix, and the Apollo was Unix enough. So HP liked this idea. We proposed this idea to HP that we would try this. And HP gave us the top-end machine, probably a 100,000-franc machine. And they gave us one guy for 3 years of our choice.
Wow.
So we chose a physicist from, I forget which collaboration, one of the LEP collaborations, who was just, his contract had just expired, who was an expert on Apollo, because the Apollo machines were being used in experiments. And he came with us, and he did the necessary liaison with the experiment to get, we worked with Opal experiment. I remember going to the operations manager, a guy called Jean-Claude Jouvet, a Swiss guy. Jean-Claude, I need a place to put this machine, this new machine, and it needs to be pretty near the Cray. He said, oh, they've just taken all the big round tape drives away, so now it's all on cassette tapes on the floor. Look, all the middle of the floor is empty. Help yourself. So we took a table, we put it in the middle of the computer center, right under the visitors gallery. We put our Apollo on it, under the floor. We'd run an Ethernet cable to the Cray. And all we had to do was to use our shell, our shell, you know, get this tape or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
And so you could stage tape data just using the Cray. And it worked like a charm. So anyway, so this thing starts working. And when it was clear that it was working, somebody connected it to the accounting system of the center. After a couple of months, the director rings up my boss, you know, and says, what is this, you know? 25% of the whole center's cycles are from this, it was called HOPE, HP Apollo something, I don't know. It was an acronym. What's this HOPE thing? That's 25% of all the CPU cycles of the whole center.
Yeah.
Cray, IBM, etc. So Modbus says, well, that's our little project with the Apollo. So he starts asking questions. Then he rings me up and says, Siegel, I've heard your machine, you're connected to the Cray. I want to know exactly what resources you're using out of the Cray for this. Because he didn't like this idea at all. He thought we were cheating. He thought, you know, how could, you know, one machine do 25% of all, you know, all these mainframes? So I sat down and I worked it out. It was 1% or 0.5% or something just for the driving the networking, you know. And so I don't know if I called him back or sent him a message. I don't know. I didn't hear from him again. And so that was the beginning of the end of the mainframes. Now, okay, it was easy because we were emulating a Unix, the Cray mainframe, okay? Yeah. But, so we sat down and we wrote a proposal. Why don't we have a network of Apollos or any sort of machine? Apollos were actually relatively expensive because they were workstations. You don't need a bitmap display to do crunching. Mm. And we wrote this proposal, okay? And it had a better history than Tim's proposal because it was actually looked at seriously and accepted by the division head, called David Williams, on condition that we could get at least one of the four LEP physics collaborations to work with us and to give us money. And if so, CERN would the IT division would match that money and let us go ahead. So we went around, I've told this story elsewhere, but we went around the four collaborations and one didn't know what we were talking about. The other one, the richest one, L3, they said, oh, we've got enough computing capacity. They had their own IBM and a lot of Apollos. The third one said, yes, as long as it's the VAX. It wasn't the VAX. And the fourth one said yes. And the fourth one had just got a new physicist collaborator, a woman from University of Indiana, and she had some money, because when you join a collaboration you have to give some money. Mm-hmm. And she or somebody else in the collaboration, they had SCSI disks that they were going to attach to their own system, but we persuaded them to attach it to our system. And so we built system. Actually, Silicon Graphics were the main machines at the beginning. And starting from 91, it took off. And by 96, I guess, we kissed off the IBM. The Cray, unfortunately, got booted out before, even though it was our model and our beloved machine. I know what we're talking about. So let's go back to Cisco. Okay. So I ordered the two Cisco boxes to filter the Cray network.
Mm-hmm.
And that was where Cisco came in. Certainly into CERN and Europe, and then later help Europe to use that to go. Right. So we were there. About the Cray and about security, we'd had to sign this agreement with the Americans. Now it turned out most of the big European centers signed the same thing as we did, but they didn't do anything about it. Like in Bologna and so they didn't actually implement anything. They just signed. And nobody checked that they were securing a machine or not. But we did. We had the Ethernet filtering, the IP filtering on a secure network.
Couldn't it be spoofed? It's easy to spoof an IP address in a LAN. Then you have collisions, but you can spoof the IP and bypass that.
If someone could spoof an IP address, they could get through, up to a point, I suppose. I don't know how strict we were on that. We were never hacked, by the way. But then we had another thing. We introduced a secure ID card so that when you logged on, it wasn't just enough to put a name and a password. You also had to have a one-time password. And I don't know who it was that discovered this little company called Secure ID in the US. And they made this card. And it was very clever, actually. It would time out and all sorts of nice things. So we bought that code, and I had to adapt it, actually. And what was so interesting was the kernel of it was beautiful code, that was doing the encryption and everything. It was beautiful, and the rest was just rubbish code. Just crap.
That's how it goes.
Yeah. But anyway, we could adapt it, and we lived with it. It was very unpopular with the physicists. First of all, in principle, because they hated the idea that Iranian colleagues couldn't have one of these cards and therefore couldn't have an account on the Cray. There were certain nationalities, even then Iran was on the blacklist,
yeah,
that we weren't allowed to give accounts to. So the administration of giving out these cards was very strictly done by CERN. The first time CERN ever did restrict things like that.
Wow.
Yeah, but anyway, it was, for CERN, it was very strict. And in fact, before the Cray came, there was no physical security in the CERN Computer Center either. You could just walk into the CERN Computer Center with your briefcase and put it next to the biggest machine you wanted, and it would blow up, no problem. It was when the Cray came that the doors were secured and you had to have little badges and stuff.
Yeah.
Like that was all due to the Cray. That was the middle of the 80s. So that was, and we had a third. What was our third security level on the Cray? I don't know. It was quite tight.
Wow.
But we weren't hacked as far as we know.
Yeah. Well, that's remarkable, especially because you such a high visible target, especially in Europe.
Yeah. Oh, there have been hacking attempts, successful hacking attempts at CERN, but not on the Cray.
Oh.
One of the very, very first hacking attempts was done on our VAX system with a famous case. It's mentioned in the book called The Cuckoo's Nest. Have you ever read that book? Yeah, it's mentioned in there. A friend of mine, again on the VAX team, saw funny activity one evening and he followed the guy. And later he made friends with the guy online, if you like.
Yeah.
And they got him because of that, finally. Wow. But he was hacking various systems.
Yeah.
That was quite early days. But on the Cray, we never got hacked.
Yeah.
But, you know, yeah, they would make checks on what people were running, this sort of thing. It was fairly... Anyway, okay, that was...
Wow.
So that's how Cisco came in. Another story about the Cisco box. So... when the Cray left, probably 1991, probably when the Cray left, 91, before the IBM, 92 probably, the two Cisco boxes were there. Mm. And I took them and I put them under my desk because they were, you know, my babies, right? And there they stayed for a long time until one day one of my friends from the operations came and said, "Ben, you know, we've got this, got our museum, you know. They have a little museum in the computer. Can we have, you know, a Cisco router?" And so I gave him, it was Cisco A and Cisco B, I gave him Cisco A. And some weeks later I went to him and said, David Underhill, where's my Cisco box? He said, "Oh, it was too big to go in the glass cabinet. We're making a new cabinet for it." And then the day after he came and he said, "Ben, we've lost it. When we realized it wouldn't fit in the cabinet, it got taken, and it was put too near the recuperation."
Oh, no.
It was just taken and thrown away with the recuperation.
It got recuperated.
Yeah. So the second one was there. I was furious. The second one was there. So the second one, some time later, I gave to the CERN Microcosm in the days when the Microcosm did have computer and stuff. And it was there for a long time. Anyway, now it's been... I got it before. It was... taken away from Microsoft. Now it's in the CERN archive storage, ready to be put on the show again. So that was the Cisco story.
Yeah,
so,
I remember the museum. That was impressive. I visited it like a decade ago, but there were a number of devices there.
Some interesting things there. Yeah. Well, it's less good now, the little museum in the IT department. But there's a girl who's supposed to put that up again. And I don't know. They're very slow. So anyway, those were exciting days.
And the
end of that then was that I think we were the first to run serious Unix clusters instead of mainframes.
Yeah.
Now, you asked about Linux. Now, Linux did not come in early. We were using proprietary Unix. And we built our shift system using different sorts of proprietary Unixes. Like for pure crunching, you could use HP had a very fast machine with, you didn't need big disk or anything. The architecture was you had compute servers, disk servers, and tape servers. So the tape servers would interface to the tape robots and stage tapes to the disks, and which were physically separate. And the compute servers would compute against the disks.
Mm-hmm.
And for that, you need a very fast network because we used network attached storage. We didn't use We didn't use NFS because NFS had a bad name.
Yeah.
It wasn't very reliable. It wasn't fast and
yeah.
so on.
Yeah.
NFS version 4 would have been better, but and AFS and stuff was much too slow. So we built our own network attached protocol. It was called RFIO, mm-hmm. and we just built our built connections, and all the tape management software was what we built for the Cray. Just transferred it, so a job could be submitted, arrive on a compute server, give its instructions that it needs these tapes. There was a huge tape management system, a whole cache system, a managed cache system on the disk servers, so you could easily check whether the particular files you needed were there already. If not, if some of them were there, you would stage what you needed, and then the job would go into execution all across the network. Now, I was in charge of the network. Now, the network is very demanding because the first, I remember doing the calculations for this. If you have a system, our target was to build a system. Our first system would be 3 times the capacity of the center, of the existing center, right? People would say to us, 3 times, you're arrogant, you're stupid, you'll never do that with Unix. Unix is rubbish. So we had this little proposal. And so I did my arithmetic.
Yeah.
We have a job which is using needs to consume such amount of data, and the data has to be first staged from tape, at least probably, and then computed against, you know, and probably only you know, one. So it depends. There are different models, and so I figured out what this network had to be capable of. So obviously, it wouldn't work with just one ether. So I designed a network that was actually as a hybrid network. So there were three levels of it. There was a very, very fast special network called UltraNet, which even had protocol processing on it. From the application, it just looked like an ordinary socket.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, your protocol overhead was done for you, and you could do very fast transfers. Mm-hmm. And they had interfaces for Sun, Silicon Graphic, a few other systems, just enough for what we need, and the Cray, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that was expensive, but we needed that for the core network. Okay, and then we had a 100 megabit network. Fast Ethernet wasn't supported at CERN. They had a horrible, expensive 100 megabit network called FTDI, very expensive. But there was a group in the network team that liked that and pushed it everywhere, so we had to use that at 100 megabit. And we had ordinary Ethernet, was 10 megabits at that time. Now, that in the end, that got replaced by gigabit Ethernet, you know, and now faster than that. But at the time, that was very advanced, in the mid-90s, well, early 90s, because it wouldn't work without a fast network like that.
Yeah,
you couldn't do it. So that was a success, and that so this Opal experiment with the first people, they were very happy, and then the other experiments, the ones that said we weren't interested in that, they came. And by the end of the 90s, everybody was on that, and there were no more mainframes anymore. And then it was at that point that we said, right, now this proprietary stuff is too expensive. Like a tape server, we used a VAX station or something. It was very expensive. Oh, and like SCSI disks. We learned that SCSI disks were the same. It was the same disk unit with an expensive controller. So we didn't realize, and we learned all of this going along. So we decided we were going to go to PCs. Right?
Same route, yeah.
So the politicians said to us, yes, you can go to PCs, but you must use NT.
Windows NT.
Yes, Windows NT. So,
okay.
So the smartest, one of the smartest programmers, who is the same guy who is now the head of the division, of the department, spent almost a year trying to make a system running NT. And he failed.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's nothing wrong with NT, but it's not
Unix.
It's not
it's not Unix. We need a Unix. Okay, but he tried. And at that point, we were allowed, and we went to Linux. Now, we didn't know a lot about Linux. And again, the management had been quite rude about Linux. I maybe told you the remark was, yeah, if there's a bug, you have to fix it yourself. That's what
right,
the management
okay.
would say, you know,
right, yeah.
as though, oh, we'd be spending all our time, you know, fixing
right.
bugs. They didn't know about, you know, communities on the network. We did get them. We decided we needed to use RAID, RAID technology on the disks, which was all the expensive disks they had RAID technology. But we found you could get a nice PCI interface
mm-hmm.
with RAID on it, mm-hmm. okay, as long as you had the driver for Linux, okay. And not only that, but you didn't have to use SCSI. You could use commodity
mm-hmm.
disks, exactly the same mechanically,
yeah.
And it cost a quarter of the price or something. And so with a PCI interface and a good driver and RAID interface and these cheap disks, we could solve the disk problem. Okay, yeah. The tape problem. Well, the tape interface was some SCSI, like I don't know what it was, but so we did all this, and for the network, we needed a gigabit Ethernet interface, and there wasn't one, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So I hired an internet guru, kernel guru, a Danish guy called Jes Sørensen, who you may have met, and he wrote the first gigabit Ethernet driver for a very nice gigabit Ethernet board, very, very nice one. And we kicked off with those. So we were really, you know, pushing on the envelope at that point. And we got this thing to run. So by the end of the 90s, we were basically all Linux. And it's never looked back from there.
Yeah, that was my experience. In 2005, I came in and it was based in Red Hat, perhaps.
Correct, Red Hat. Again, they didn't have the real courage to go Fedora or something. You know, they wanted support.
It does make sense. Ultimately, that's Red Hat recently bought by, I forget who, but Red Hat's been immensely successful as a company providing support for Linux. It's an example of a win-win situation.
Right. So we've got the Linux expertise now. So it's that was 20 years,
yeah.
no, 15 years since I would say things like, we should run Unix on everything, and people would say, shut up, you're arrogant. So anyway, that's some of the more recent stuff.